Hello everyone, it's March 12th, 2024. It's been a slowish news week in spaceflight, and we haven't talked about Stoke Space in a while. Stoke might be the most innovative out there when it comes to rocket upper stages, but now they're making progress on their first stage as well. You need both, so let's talk about them both, and liftoff! Hey, Mr. Vitar, welcome to episode 450 of the Total Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben.
And Dennis is out sick, so it's just us two.
Feel better soon, Dennis.
Since it was, I think, a relatively light space news week, and what little there is, we're totally going to cover. But did you see any good movies lately?
No.
Okay, well, so what was the last movie you saw in a theater?
Oh, geez, I don't even know. Probably it was one of the Star Wars movies, and I don't think a particularly good one.
So I guess the big movie out right now is Dune 2, which I've not seen yet.
But you saw the first one?
Yeah. In fact, I think we might have talked about that on the show
when that came
out. But it's funny, it did inspire me to rewatch Blade Runner 2049, which...
Oh, yeah.
It's the same director, and I had seen it probably, I don't know, like a year or two ago. But it always amazes me how much I don't remember unless I watch it multiple times. And then I kind of know it by heart, but I have to watch it like three or four times. So I'm kind of like rewatching it and going, I don't remember half of this, you know? It's kind of strange.
Was surprised at how good the movie was, but yeah, I don't remember much about it at all.
But yeah, so I just kind of, you know, decided to watch a different Denis Villeneuve movie. So I was like, okay, I'm just going to watch Blade Runner 2049 instead, which I think, honestly, I probably liked more than the first Dune movie, which is also good. Like, I don't think I was quite on the same hype train that everyone else was. I mean, I do love sci-fi, but I just wasn't blown away by it, but I did like it a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on what kind of nerd you are, what kind of sci-fi nerd you are.
Yeah, anyway, I guess we can end it there.
But... Yeah. Movie talk accomplished.
Stoke Space. I guess we're just going to do a little update on Stoke Space. I don't know how much new news there is.
Yeah.
Maybe this is new compared to the last time we talked about it.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. So the new news is that they did a stand engine test, right? Last time we talked about them, they had just done the little hop test. Mm-hmm. And that was with not only a smaller version of their upper stage and they will actually fly, but also it had like fewer engines.
Yeah, I think it was like half as many.
Yeah. Is it that the stand test had all the engines?
It looks like it's, all 30 engines.
Yeah. So that's the news, which like isn't that much to talk about, but like we want to talk about Stoke Space. So we're gonna.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we hadn't talked about it in a while, and I'm glad to see that they're making so much progress. And we'll talk about a little bit as to why they're able to do that. Yeah. So that was the upper stage test. But I guess the bigger announcement that I don't know if we talked about this, and this was announced back in October, but again, I don't think we've talked about Stoke Space. Mm-mm. Since then, is that they did receive a $100 million funding round, and that allowed them to begin work on the first stage of this rocket, because obviously the second stage is in many ways much more impressive because it's just this whole new concept, but they do need to build a reusable first stage, or it would be kind of funny now that I think about it. And yeah. Like, what if you made a rocket that had a expendable first stage and reusable second stage? What a concept. That would be new. And it would be interesting if they, I mean, not that that's how things would end, but if they had more success with the upper stage, but they still had trouble bringing the first stage back. How ironic.
Yeah, I think we can pretty much put money on the fact that it's going to be harder to reuse that upper stage. Just, due to basic physics and examples of that physics through history.
Yeah. I guess we should talk a little bit about how the upper stage works, right? Just as a refresher. So this is basically something kind of like an aerospike, but not an aerospike at all, but it does kind of look like one. I can't remember how you described it.
Oh, I don't know if I had a clever way of describing it, but yeah, basically like they solved one problem and wound up kind of converging on what looks like an aerospike, and they do get a little bit of, aerospike like benefit, but for the most part, it does not function like an aerospike.
Are you talking about during second stage deployment or reentry? Because now I don't think we made that distinction. Okay. At any point. Yeah. So once it's deployed, and obviously at this point, you're pretty much you are in space for all intents and purposes. I don't think the aerospike effect really means anything, right? Like, do aerospikes have any type of a benefit apart from being optimized over the course of the ascent? But once you're in space, you really just want a nozzle that's designed for a vacuum, and an aerospike nozzle isn't necessarily that. But I mean, obviously that's not what this is designed for.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to segment things out like that, and say that the ascent through the atmosphere is one regime and then being on orbit is a different one. Yeah, sure. There are disadvantages to a narrow spike compared to a traditional bell nozzle when you're in space. Like, you wouldn't really want to send an arrow spike to Mars as your main engine unless you were going to be using it in the atmosphere as well. But I mean, kind of the benefit of the arrow spike is that it is pretty good in space and pretty good at sea level, and it's kind of the mid range for everything, and that's a good thing.
But I guess my point is that it's not really about the boost to orbit, it's about the reentry, and that's kind of where this comes into play. Mm-hmm. The way this thing works is that it has this large steel heat shield on the bottom, and of course it has this little annular ring of much smaller engines, and the liquid hydrogen, which is the fuel, is actually circulated through that large steel plate or belly, that heats up, and then that creates pressure. That exhaust is fed through those nozzles, so it's a clever way to keep the bottom of the spacecraft cool. In fact, so cool, at least in some tests, that it, actually came back like covered in frost. But, this wasn't from orbital reentry. That would be something different. But yeah, I mean, it's a clever idea.
So I think a good way to think about this is the fact that Stoke was originally thinking about flowing water through their heat shield to cool it. And that would work. Actually, it would probably work better than hydrogen, because water can soak up so much heat energy before changing state. And the reason that they didn't do that is just because of all the weight of having separate water tanks and pumps and plumbing. And so instead they, are using a little bit less efficient of a cooling fluid, liquid hydrogen. And what that does is eliminate all that, all the part redundancy. And what's really cool is, like, they also don't need to have pumps for this. I mean, they do, but like, they don't need to run those pumps at all, really, because the hydrogen does change state pretty quickly. And so all of this liquid hydrogen will turn into steam, which changes the pressure dramatically, or changes the volume that it takes up dramatically. Yeah. And so it drives itself as it, they use that increased pressure to drive the pumps. That's really handy when you're running the engine. You basically get a free, like, expander cycle, right? And they're also going to be cooling the heat shield when the engines are not running by flowing liquid hydrogen through it. And so that means that they're dumping gaseous hydrogen overboard during their reentry sequence, right? Like, they don't get to capture it again. They're going to have to bring a little extra fuel than oxidizer, but like, because it has this dual purpose, that's okay.
So I guess one natural question would be, why not just have a traditional heat shield? So yeah, like, why not just do that? I mean, I think I know the answer, but would that weigh that much more than this whole system when you have a whole bunch of little engines, which actually do mean more mass than having just, one large vacuum engine, at least from what I believe the CEO said, because you're having to route all this machinery around the circumference of the spacecraft. So why not just do a heat shield?
Well, if you're going to do a heat shield, where would you put the engine?
I think that's the main, The other solution, right? I mean, the one that SpaceX never tried was to maybe put the heat shield on the side and then bring it in that way.
SpaceX also was looking at retracting the main engine so that less of the bell was exposed.
Right. And then that's the other problem, is that you have, that large bell being exposed.
Yeah. So you could swing a heat shield around to cover the engine nozzle. You could fire the engine as you're doing your reentry to, form a gas shield to push that compression layer farther away from you, so that you get less heat, by radiative, heating. But like, aside from the physical layout, the other issue is that if you want to make your vehicle reusable, if you use a traditional ablative heat shield, you're going to be replacing that heat shield every mission or every X number of missions. It's all trade-offs. A regeneratively cooled heat shield is more easy to reuse, but it's heavier. Yeah. You could do it a bunch of different ways. This is just the set of choices that Stoke Space has made.
And just to be clear, I think that, well, at least so far, I think it's the right choice. I mean, this is very innovative and it looks like it might actually work. So it's something that no one had ever thought of. And then, you know, I mean, then, you know, they do. And it's just like, wow, that never occurred to me that you could do that, you know, very innovative.
Yeah. We like the weird stuff because, you know, even if it fails in an interesting way, or at least leaves an interesting mark on history. So yeah, I totally agree. And I think you're right. I think this is a good set of choices. Like it seems pretty promising from, you know, my armchair perspective.
But yeah, so going back to the first stage, right? So this is going to be fueled by liquid natural gas and liquid oxygen, and it will have seven engines. So yeah, seven engines in liquid natural gas. And to me, that kind of confused me. And we had a little talk about this before we started recording what exactly liquid natural gas is, but it seems to be sort of like a mixture of gases. And apparently that's intentional because that's meant to bring the costs of this down because you don't have to, I guess, purify methane. Is that kind of right? Like it just costs more to do just methane.
Yeah. It's like, you know, they're using, a standard steel, for their heat shield and for the spacecraft body, the tanks and everything, rather than using an expensive, aerospace, designed alloy that's harder to work with and more expensive and has fewer suppliers. So, a much more delicate supply chain. So like they made that choice with the steel. They made that choice with the fuel for the first stage as well. So liquid natural gas is widely available and used in the transport industry. So this is sort of like saying that you're going to use automotive fuel instead of RP1 grade kerosene for your first stage engine. And yeah, I knew that liquid natural gas was like a common thing. I know that it is sort of a byproduct of petroleum mining. But I had to go look up the exact composition because it's one, like you said, it's a mix and it's mostly methane, but there's also propane, ethane, butane and some other things in there. And yeah, so to get from that to pure methane, you have to do all the refining processes or, you know, potentially synthesize methane out of like carbon dioxide from the atmosphere or whatever.
I'm wondering what kind of specific impulse you can get with liquid natural gas compared to methane.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think another good question to ask is how coke resistant is it? Like, is this going to impact the reusability if you have incomplete combustion, which, you know, presumably would also be paired with lower efficiency. But yeah, I mean, we'll see. I think fortunately, if they wanted to switch from LNG to methane, they could pretty easily. So what are they calling their first stage?
I don't know what they're calling the first stage. The whole rocket is being called Nova.
Oh, I see. Okay.
It looks kind of Falcon 9-ish. Definitely squatter. More stout.
Yeah,
squatter, which I kind of like. I don't know. It kind of looks cool. This will be capable of a return to launch site and it can land downrange. I don't know if that means on a drone ship. I imagine it would have to.
Yeah, it depends where they're flying it from. But generally, you don't want to fly it over land, so probably.
Yeah. It also looks very Falcon 9-ish in that it has these landing legs that look pretty much just like them. Just again, smaller, like stouter. So the diameter is 3.7 meters, and that's, I believe that's significantly thicker around than a Falcon 9, right?
No, actually, I think it's exactly the same diameter. Yeah,
exactly the same. Okay. Yeah, so it's the same diameter as the Falcon 9, but quite a bit shorter. That kind of makes me wonder if, you know, maybe at some point they might just lengthen that first stage. And I'm kind of wondering why they don't. And for the dev tank, which was built not too long ago, which is basically, you know, I guess short for, you know, development tank. They did make it the full diameter, but they did make it shorter. But it looks like, according to the website, that the actual final rocket is going to be significantly shorter still. So, I mean, it's not going to get that much longer. And so I guess it's not necessary. Like it doesn't need to be a tall rocket, but it totally could be.
I suspect that it comes down to how much mass the first stage is going to want to carry. Cause you can't really expand that first stage past, you know, some critical point. The taller it gets, the less aerodynamically stable it is, the more reentry heating you experience, right? If it's taller but not wider, its ballistic coefficient goes up. And so you wind up having to push through hotter and hotter atmosphere. So I think the second stage is going to be driving the size of the first stage, but its proportions look very similar to New Shepard, which shouldn't be terribly surprising.
Now I'm wondering about the size of New Shepard, because that's just a suborbital launch right. vehicle. And yet, and I thought that something that size, you know, would have to be suborbital. Like, you can't put that into orbit. But this, you know, is also pretty small.
So New Shepard is also 3.7 meters in diameter, and the whole stack is 18 meters tall. The whole stack for Nova is 30 and a half meters tall. So it is stretched compared to New Glenn, or to New Shepard, which makes sense given its different destination.
So we were talking about the choice to go with stainless steel. I thought that was interesting. So I was watching the interview that NASA Space Flight did with the CEO, whose name is Andy Lapsa, and he talked about why they made that choice. And yeah, unsurprisingly, it's because it is just cheaper and it's much easier to work with. And that allows them to try new things and then try and build new things much faster. And one other thing that allows that is that he said that they don't have any fixed tooling. So basically, like, everything that they manufacture there, they do with, quote, no fixed tooling. And the host had asked him exactly what that means. He said, does that mean that you don't have, like, you know, these huge mandrels or something? And he said, yeah. So I don't know how they're doing what they do with no large tools. But that's what Andy said, like, you know, because that would represent costs that they can't necessarily afford. So you want to keep things that are much more like multi-purpose, because fixed tooling generally means, you know, for one specific vehicle or for one specific purpose. And I'm sure that there are some things, you know, that kind of fall into that category, but it seems that by and large, no huge machines that can do just this one thing. So I thought that was kind of cool. And then maybe once you have your final design, you can move up to large, you know, fixed tooling, because you're going to be like making just that one particular rocket or whatever.
Yeah. When you go into like full manufacturing. Yeah. They may,
yeah,
or they may not. Like, I don't know enough about rocket manufacturing to guess.
I mean, I certainly don't. Yeah. And so the other reason for steel, cause I think that, again, the CEO, he really wanted to make this point. It does have the better thermodynamics, at least marginally, maybe. I'm not sure what the margin is, but when compared to aluminum, it does do better. And the trade off, he said, was such that, you know, you just want to go with the stainless steel. Maybe the aluminum is, you know, lighter, but that's not good enough. And just to demonstrate the point of how important, say, liquid circulation is in order to cool down your stainless steel, or possibly in this case, aluminum, he talked about the shuttle. And I didn't know this about the shuttle. Maybe you did. But apparently after landing, the heat tiles, you know, because they're still hot and they do cause a certain amount of heat soak into the main structure of the shuttle, they would actually have to circulate water through that aluminum substructure just to keep it from, you know, being damaged. And I didn't know that was something that was done. I thought that maybe the tiles just cooled off and that there was no need to do such a thing. But yeah, you still have to cool down the aluminum substructure, because eventually the heat is going to get from one side of that tile to the other. And I suppose that that's what's happening, right? Because I think it's sort of like heat travels slowly through them. Mm-hmm.
Very slowly.
And so, yeah, eventually it'll get to the aluminum, and you don't want that happening. So yeah, you still have to run a liquid through the space shuttle's little undercarriage there, which I didn't know.
And if I remember right, the whole like post-landing sequence is sort of a dance where you're having to make sure that the vehicle is safe to approach, but you need to approach it pretty quickly, not only to get the people out, but to hook up water tanks, because I believe the water was supplied externally. I don't think they took it to space to come and service this thing. And, you know, when I... as a kid, when I got to go see the shuttle land just right next to my house, like literally less than a half hour's drive, there would, you know, the thing would come down and land, and then there would just be a ton of activity. And I never understood what all the activity was, because I was like, oh, like, you know, I'm a child. And so I'm like, oh, cool. Let's celebrate the astronauts and like, let's have them come out and let's focus on the people. Why is this machine getting so much attention? You know, everybody that I knew that worked on shuttle, was always super busy for the next, you know, like month or whatever. And I remember in particular one engineer being like, okay, so we should have shuttle mated to, the shuttle carrier vehicle. Or the shuttle carrier aircraft this week, and then things will kind of been calmed down and I can, you know, get back to doing what I normally do. It's a very high maintenance machine, the shuttle is. So it's interesting that they are comparing themselves to that and saying, this not going to be that big of a deal. And so we'll have to see how less of a big deal it is. That that's a very good thing to aim for, at least hopefully to accomplish.
Yeah.
So what was the thermal property that they were saying was better for stainless than aluminum? Because aluminum has a much higher thermal conductivity than stainless, like an order of magnitude higher.
Yeah. Sorry, I might have misspoke, but I meant the mass penalty that you have. So basically, aluminum is lighter.
And you said that there was some property that would make them want to go with stainless anyway.
Yeah. So basically, just because it's cheaper and easier to machine and so forth, at least that's...
Oh, okay.
He said that they can import, you know, just raw sheet metal, and then they can turn that into a spaceship, which I guess for aluminum, you can't do that, right? You have to like carve out aluminum. Is that how that works? I don't know anything about
machining. Yeah, aluminum work hardens very quickly. You really can't. You can't bend sheet aluminum very easily. Like you can, I believe you can do it, but like you need to have very specialized techniques and machines. But okay. So the trade-off, what you're saying is that the trade-off isn't an immediately clear trade-off. You have to look at the cost of manufacturing and the supply chain and everything. And then it's just like, oh, well, this trade-off is actually they're pretty similar to each other. And so we're going to pick the manufacturing benefits and take the hit on mass.
It just saves money to use steel. It's just easier. Mm-hmm. I think that probably is the main thing because I think if you're using aluminum, going back to the no fixed tooling, you're going to need fixed tooling, right? If you're working with aluminum, most likely.
I mean, I don't know how you don't. I mean, like you basically have to use stir friction welding. You can weld aluminum, but just not well. Like it's very difficult. And I think that was one of the things that was said in the interview was like, if you go with aluminum, you're basically restricting your hiring pool down to, you know, like five people. Whereas if you use steel, there are so many people that are good at working with steel in this sort of environment that you can just hire from a much larger pool of talent.
But yeah, I guess that covers it, right? So that was a good Stoke Space update. All right, so let's do three short and sweets this week. Ben, what is the first one?
Tianhe's solar arrays have been patched. An eight-hour spacewalk was conducted on March 2nd by mission commander Tong Hongbo and taikonaut Jiang Xingling aboard Tiangong. Micrometeoroid impacts had apparently degraded the solar array's performance, and repair efforts have reportedly returned the array to normal power generation.
Next up, Stratolaunch tests Talon. TA-1 had a successful test flight on March 9th that took the hypersonic testbed close to Mach 5. While Stratolaunch has not disclosed the specific speed altitude achieved, this flight is a major milestone for the company. The vehicle was powered by Hadley, a 3D-printed 5,000-pound stage combustion Kerlox engine built by Ursa Major. In the second half of the year, Stratolaunch plans to fly a reusable version of the plane called TA-2, and TA-3 is already under construction. The company is also working on a second mothership using a 747 they bought from Virgin Orbit's bankruptcy auction.
And finally, Starship Flight 3 is on its way. Rather than targeting a splashdown near Hawaii, this third flight is headed for the Indian Ocean. This new flight profile allows for an in-space Raptor burn. The flight is also planned to test opening and closing the payload bay door, nicknamed the PEZ dispenser, as well as transferring propellant from the main tanks to the header tanks. FAA is working on a launch license for a mid-March launch.
All right, so let's move on to this week in spaceflight history. We have no winners, so apparently my clue was really hard. The clue was a 154-day mission, but only for the passengers.
That's a weird clue, bud.
Yeah, that is weird, but I think everyone will instantly get it as soon as I reveal what this mission was. Yeah, so the event was the 16th of March, 1966, and it was the recovery of Vietorok and Ugoljok. I don't know how to say that word.
Yeah.
Who to this day hold the record for the longest canines in space. So yeah, they were dogs.
Well, the longest canines in space sounds like they were wiener dogs.
Yeah, I misread that. The longest canine spaceflight, not canines in space. Those would probably be wiener dogs. Although I'm sure there's a dog that holds that record too. I don't know who though.
Yeah, I mean, right. So like, it depends on whether we're talking about overall length or aspect ratio.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, so the clue, right? So 154-day mission, but just for the passengers. That's because I was calculating a 22-day mission in dog years. You get it?
Yeah, so okay,
apparently that was
right.
A bad idea.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. And I didn't even bother to check my math until after I, you know, did that clue, but it does work out. So like I had always had it in my brain that a dog year was roughly 7 years to every human year, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that seven. is like the general practice, but there are other ways of calculating this that actually vary depending on how old the dog is. So it's actually kind of complicated, but the most common system, I think, for most people is, you know, a 1 to 7 difference. So yeah, 154 is 22 times 7. That's all that is. I thought that would have been easier.
Well, I mean, from an outside perspective, you have to have a reason to divide that by 7. So
yeah, true. I mean, but still, I mean, people figure this stuff out, and I'm always amazed how
they really do
good the guesses are. But they didn't get this one. But yeah, so Vyacharok and Ugoyok.
Yeah, these are very good space dogs. So like all of the Russian space dogs are super super cute, and I think it's down to the fact that they were intentionally using mutts and like street dogs, and mixed breed dogs are just so cute because they get, you know, long fur with color patterns that you wouldn't really expect. And I don't know, these two dogs are just so cute. And the publicity photo that's on Wikipedia, their eyes are lit in just the right way that they look really watery and, you know, big and bright and just very, very good.
Yeah. And I think also what contributes to the cuteness is the fact that they're small, because they generally need to be. You can't put like a, you know, Great Dane in a space capsule.
I mean, they're smaller. All of the Russian space or the Soviet space dogs are all smaller than my terrier mix, who's, you know, not a large dog.
And I think that they're all, I don't know about the other ones. I think that they're all basically just like what, stray dogs that were collected off of the street somewhere, right?
Yeah, that was my understanding, which I wonder if that's as weird of a thing. Like today we really don't have that many stray dogs on the streets in America, but like even in America, like stray dogs used to be a much more common thing. The US went through like a no stray animal surge. But like, you know, you used to elect a dog catcher. Like that used to be an elected position because maintaining the dog population, or keeping the dog population under control, used to be a much bigger deal. And now that we've had such a strong push for, neutering animals, it's still a little bit of a problem. Like in Australia, they've got a lot of stray cats. But anyway, all that to say, like now when you have a stray dog, they're kind of terrifying. And I think it used to not be as weird to, you know, take in a stray dog and have it be a good animal. Okay, so to get back to the space dogs, what do their names mean? Because like Laika, her name means barker, and Belka and Strelka, the second and third, who for some reason are my favorite two space dogs, mean squirrel and little arrow. So what do Vyacharok and Ugoyok, what do they mean?
So Vyacharok means breeze. Okay. So that's kind of nice. That's cute.
Farty dog. Got it.
Yeah. And then the second name, as far as I can tell, it means coal, like, you know, charcoal. But actually the word for charcoal, I think is actually, you don't put on the yolk. It's just like
Ugol,
but the Ugol yolk, maybe that does mean, maybe it means like a piece of charcoal or something. I'm not sure.
Wikipedia suggests it means ember.
Ember? Okay. That might be right. Because the translations I had read, so basically a lot of this information I gathered from Russian sources. And so you just, you know, use like Google Translate and it translates the name as charcoal. So that's just what it, you know, spits out. But yeah, I think ember sounds better. So we can go with that. But yeah, so the mission, so Cosmos 110, that was the mission, that these canines were launched on. And, this was really to perform a number of experiments on various biologicals, but the two stars of the show are like obviously the dogs. I think everything else was like fruit flies and fungus and things like that. But, the spacecraft was actually a modified Voskhod. So modified because you had to accommodate these plants, but also the dogs because they were not just, you know, free floating inside the capsule, as cute as that sounds. That was not practical. So yeah, so why two dogs? And I guess this is maybe also what was done with Bielka and Strelka. You have one that is basically the control where you don't do anything. It's just kind of, I guess, there along for the ride, although you do have to feed it and so forth. And then the other one is the one upon which you conduct these experiments.
That seems treatment to be, group.
Right, treatment group. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah, treatment with things such as radiation therapy and things of that nature.
Great.
So, well, I shouldn't say radiation therapy. We'll get into that. And I did honestly like leave some things out because if you're not into hearing about dogs, like, you know, going through some pretty hard conditions, and you're not going to want to listen to this, but I made it, I don't know, a little bit more palatable.
You sanitized it a little bit.
Yeah. So this was a 22-day long study for the long-term effects of weightlessness and increased exposure to radiation. Now, the orbit was 190 by 882 kilometers, and that was because that apogee puts them in the lower belt of the Earth's radiation belt. Yeah, that was intentional because this was all to, you know, get an idea of how long-term spaceflight might affect human beings. Now, prior to this, you know, there obviously had been humans in space, but I don't know for how long. This clearly 22 days, I think, would have been. Yeah, this actually was the record, which was later broken. I don't remember how much later, but by a Russian crew of, you know, humans this time. But yeah, so they're trying to get some idea for long-term effects. So the preparation. So how do you prepare dogs to fly in space? Skipping past the physical conditioning, which means a lot of, you have to put them in those situations and I guess gradually grow them accustomed to it, because at first they might not be too particularly happy with it. But as far as what was done to the dogs specifically, things were a little bit invasive, but nothing permanently bad. And spoiler alert, they actually did make it back fine and they grew to a happy old age. They were fine. So they were happy dogs afterwards. But during this, you know, like, I think that during this mission, maybe they weren't so happy. I can only imagine. But yeah, preparing for the flight. They were fixed with radiation dosimeters. I don't know if they were necessarily invasive, although I think some of them were, but they were definitely fixed with these, you know, little dosimeters on all parts of their bodies. They had a lot of stuff hooked up to them. So they each had their own little cabin, which really, if you look at photos, which you can find in those links, I'm not sure which one, these cabins are not much larger than the dogs themselves. I mean, they really are like...
Yeah, they're like little carriers. Yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, they're even smaller than carriers, honestly. I mean, they look like it to me. But I guess it doesn't really matter because they weren't able to move around inside of it very much. But yeah, so they had these cabins. So I'm using the Russian translation. I don't know what the actual English would be because this is all just translated by Google. But yeah, cabins or crates that had to be put into the module and fixed in there. So how do you feed dogs in space? Well, you kind of don't. You just have to feed them through a fistula. So yeah, the food was was actually administered. Yeah, it was actually administered directly into their stomachs, both the food and the water. And it was kind of standard canine food. It was like a mixture of, you know, I think they said like meat, potatoes, things like that. Kind of like what you'd feed a person, but it was all just, you know, turned into a paste and fed directly to them, whether they wanted it or not, just once a day. Yeah, along with water, but maybe not enough because when they came back, apparently they were very thirsty. Yeah, so that was one surgical thing that was done there. Another one, in order to measure blood pressure, they had to somehow, I guess, partially remove the left carotid artery into a skin flap. So I guess they kind of like unseated it and then they put a little clamp on there, which is able to measure the blood pressure. I'm trying to visualize that. I don't really want to, but yeah, they had to move an artery, essentially.
Yeah, pull it out from under the mass and the connective tissue and muscle.
Right.
And almost make it a hernia, almost, yeah.
Yeah, kind of. And then they put a little clamp on there, and then that's how they measure blood pressure. So not great. Then there were also subcutaneous electrodes that were implanted in the carotid sinus, a different part of, like, I guess, the dog's head. That was to record myograms, which I believe, again, the Russian, that's the Russian translation, but I couldn't find any good English, but apparently that's just to measure muscle contractions.
Yeah, like that's part of the carotid artery, right? So
right.
That's not muscle, that's vein.
Or, right. So it's probably tissue. Or heart. Yeah. So maybe it's to measure the heart muscle specifically, but the Russian translation didn't give that information. And then there were also some vascular catheters that were used for administering drugs and pharmaceuticals, and they were also used for taking blood samples. So they had that stuck in them too. And yeah, and again, this is all like for 22 days. Sounds not fun. The dogs did have their own little flight suits. They were kind of like one size fits all for any dog between 6 and 10 kilograms, which again, they would have to be in order to fit in those little crates because you can't put a big dog in there at all. And so once they're in the crates, they're actually secured by these nylon straps that held them kind of like in place so that they couldn't bump up against the walls, right? So you couldn't go too far in any direction and you couldn't even really touch the ground. I mean, they could probably stand up like if there was gravity, but they couldn't, you know, fall and like lie on the ground if, you know, like if there were gravity.
They couldn't stretch out.
Right. They were just being suspended. I mean, well, they could stretch and that was the idea so that they could move their legs and, you know, stretch their legs, but they couldn't move their bodies in any one direction. They could just flip and flail about.
So, sorry, I looked into the carotid sinus myogram and it looks like it's been studied. It was actually studied in the 1960s. So like this would be the right era, as a way to look at the reflex of shivering from cold,
which would
be right muscle. And so they were, this paper that I'm looking at is actually looking at suppressing, shivering, but yeah, I don't know what the exact connection is, but yeah, it's using like an electrode and looking at muscle activity. So in this study, they used rabbits and, they put pressure on the carotid sinus with like little clamps or clips. And by push, they were looking at whether pushing on the sinus prevented the reflex shiver. And in some cases, they actually cut out that part of the vascular system, like cut the carotid sinus out, keeping the nerves in place, but so that there's not blood run through it so that then they could make it into a little, I guess, a little pocket and they could change the pressure inside of it by infusing it with lactated ringers. So like saline. And so they could make it swell it up and then inflate it like a balloon and then deflate it. And they're looking at the relationship between that. And so like this rabbit study seems absolutely horrendous. And I wonder if it was something relatively similar that they were doing with the dogs, looking at the connection of pressure on the carotid sinus and whether they were shivering or not.
Maybe. Probably don't want to look into it any further then, right? Yeah. So getting on to one other, this is probably like one of the, I don't know if it's the worst thing that was done to these poor animals, but they had to undergo immobilization training. So basically several times, I think 3 or 4 times, these animals, and by the way, there was up to 30 of them because like I said, these were the best two of a whole squad, I think was the word that was used. But yeah, a whole squad of dogs, at least I don't know. Again, I don't know what the Russian was, but that was the English translation. But they were subjected to 55 days, like up to 55 days of not being able to move or at least having very, very restricted movement. So they could move their limbs, but they couldn't actually go anywhere. And it was found that up to 20 days was the maximum. And what happens after 20 days, you don't want to know. I don't think any of them died, but it's not fun. It sounds like torture. I mean, it basically is. So 20 days is about as long as you can go. And that's why this mission was 22 days. Because after that, you're not going to get any good data. So yeah, 20 days is your maximum. So let's get into the launch. So it was launched on the 26th of February, 1966. The capsule returned 22 days later. And, yeah, I think I'd already mentioned they received food once a day by way of command from ground control. And then Vyacharok received, since he's not the control, he's the, what do you call it?
The treatment group.
The treatment group. Yeah, geez, that's such a simple phrase I can never remember. The treatment group, he received anti-radiation or some kind of an anti-radiation agent, like intravenously. So again, that catheter, but the other dog did not. Yeah, I didn't get into too much of the experience done because a lot of it was just, you know, passive measurement for the most part. The first 7 days, apparently the dogs were very anxious, which is not surprising. They're in zero G, probably for the first time.
Probably for the first time. Definitely for the first time.
Well, I mean, maybe like a short, you know, flight, like a little vomit comet flight or something. Yeah. But it's quite possible this was their very first time in zero G at all. So they were trying to move around in a way that was, you know, not working for them because obviously this is completely new and they don't have any idea what's going on. But by about the eighth or ninth day, they, and this is an interesting quote, they reconciled themselves. So it's almost like they just kind of gave up and then they just, you know, became much, much calmer. And they didn't move around as quickly, because they realized that they were kind of stuck.
Well, and they're also probably less vigorous because they've been in this condition for a week.
Right. Well, they like definitely suffered some, you know, like physical, I guess like the muscular degeneration and things of that sort. But I mean, that's why this was all being done because at the time we didn't know how bad those effects were. So that's why they did this in order to find out how bad it got. So yeah. And then on day 10, I thought this was interesting. They did a live TV broadcast. The Soviet state, I forget what it was called, the Soviet state news network or something. They did a live broadcast twice during a day showing the dogs who seemed, I guess, in pretty good spirits, all things considered. I mean, they didn't really do much. They were known to be very quiet. I guess they were just there floating. And I don't know how long of a clip it was. I actually tried to find some clips and I'm sure I would have been able to, but I kept getting Strelka and Bielka or Bielka. Or I can't say the name. I kept getting those other two astronaut dogs or cosmonaut dogs because they're the much more famous ones. But yeah, by day 21, just a day before the return, there was a deterioration of the cabin air that was measured. And I'm wondering if maybe this was why they brought them back. I mean, if I don't know how long they would have to wait before they were able to do a reentry if they had not done it on the 16th of March. But like I said, I think it's maybe just because 20 days is about the maximum. And luckily, the recovery went without incident. Once they were taken out of their little crates, a lot of their hair fell out in place. And I read that it was like patches, but I think one eyewitness said they just didn't have any hair, although I'm sure there was some there, but they were basically just like skin. It was like these little hairless dogs. So I don't know if that's stress or something else. I mean, who knows what could cause that? I don't know what causes a dog to lose all its hair, but
I mean, stress will do it, but also
diaper rash.
Yeah, like I was going to say, like, you know, basically if you're that restricted, you're probably going to get bed sores. I mean, not as much pressure as laying about on Earth, but like, you know, you're going to get all this irritation and they're not able to groom themselves. So he's like all the stress and anxiety on top of it. Yeah. Just,
yeah. They did have bed sores. They had a diaper rash, weren't in good condition. They couldn't stand up on their own. So which like I said, is not surprising now. I mean, since we now know that at least a human, I don't think would be able to stand up on their own after 22 days of complete immobilization, right? Like I don't think you'd be able to stand up.
We do like a negative slope immobility studies still today with humans where you're on a bed, where your feet are slightly higher than your head. And yeah, you're pretty weak afterwards. But I mean, if you think about people who've been on the space station, granted they're usually up there for longer, but even with workout equipment, they still find it difficult to maintain, you know, to support their own weight once they get back. So yeah, it's no shock.
Yeah. But very silent. Once again, which to me just makes it all the more poignant that they didn't bark, you know, they were pretty quiet. But and there was some impaired heart function that was measured. Again, not surprising. I think it, what's the term? Heart palpitations. Yeah. Studies that were done, I think several months later, found that there was a large number of abnormal cells in the reproductive organs. But again, a little spoiler, they did have puppies. By the way, I'm assuming, I don't know if these are females or males, but I'm assuming males just because of the names. I actually don't know. And I tried looking at the original Russian.
I think all the Soviet dogs were all female.
Okay, so maybe they were female, and if that's the case, then, you know, they had puppies, so it wasn't too extensive, the damage. So, yeah, and they did live long, healthy lives afterwards, so it did have a happy ending. And again, I skipped some other things. I think the one, this is not horrible, but it just, again, reading it, it felt much worse, maybe, than it was, and I don't like to think about it, but they had to have their tails docked, apparently, which is a common practice for dogs, but it just seemed kind of gruesome, because the whole reason for it was that the tails were getting in the way of some of the equipment, you know, like they were just too long, so it's like they had to lose their tails just because they were too long for those little cages that they were in. They seemed like in a pretty sorry state when they came back, but they did get better. So it has a happy ending, but the people on the ground when they were getting the dogs out of the capsule, they seem pretty shocked by it. Like, to be honest, like that was at least the vibe that I got, was that they didn't fully appreciate just how bad the conditions were after 22 days of, you know, just being in space and you're a dog and, you know, you can't, like you said, you can't groom yourself for anything, right? Like they're not like living. They're just being held and being fed through a tube. That sounds like, I don't know, that's kind of like Neo in the Matrix, you know, like you have stuff stuffed into you in your little vat. Like, it's just horrible.
Well, I was just going to say, like, on the note of stuff, the things stuffed into you, that's, I actually figured it out. They were all female dogs. And the reason that they were female, they started with male dogs, but they switched to female dogs because they were easier to catheterize for urine.
And a catheter on top of it.
Yeah. And no care, like medical care, no interaction with people or dogs. And, you know, dogs are such social creatures. Like,
yeah, it's like, it's really like horrible. I mean, that's why I didn't dwell on it too much. Otherwise, I don't think I would be able to even get through it. So that's how I manage it. But like I said, at least it's a happy ending, you know, and dogs are at least very forgiving animals, I think.
They're trusting. They
seem fine afterwards.
Yeah. They don't attribute that period to the people who did it to them. They're just like, hey guys, the weirdest thing happened. I'm glad to be home.
But anyway, yeah, so that's it. Vyetarok and Ugoyok, two more of the Soviet canines in space.
Great. I'm going to have to go snuggle with my dogs after this.
Yeah. Sorry for the somewhat depressing topic and the impossible clue too, but hopefully the clue for the next one will be easier. So yeah. So for that clue, all right. So this one might be just as difficult. The date range is the 19th of March through the 25th of March. And Ben, what is that clue?
All right. Next week in 2017, the clue is dry, wet, and lumpy.
Okay. Well, at least there's no dividing by seven involved in that one. I'm
not sure. But, you don't know that.
So that should make it easier. But if you have a guess as to what this clue is referencing, you can email us at info@theorbitalmechanics.com or shoot us a toot on Mastodon and use the hashtag ThisWeekSF. Or you can visit theorbitalmechanics.com/Discord for an invite to our Discord server and type /twistif or TWSF to hand your guest directly to our Tombot. And good luck.
Good luck, everybody.
So let's move on to upcoming spaceflight events then. And thank you to Launch Library 2, which is where we begin our research each week. And we have four launches. Yeah, so four events, and they're all launches. What's the first launch?
Yep. First up, we mentioned this last week. It's Kairos. It's the first flight of this vehicle by Space One is the company. Like I said, we mentioned them last week. They got delayed. Their actual first launch was scrubbed, apparently due to a wayward boat. They're all over the globe, right? So now they are targeting Wednesday, March 13th, sometime between 0201 hours and 0217 hours UTC.
Then after that, on the 13th as well, is a Falcon 9 Block 5, and that's carrying Starlink Group 644. So another batch of Starlink satellites. Yep, nothing much to say there. The launch window is 2329 UTC through 0400 UTC the next day. So big 4-hour launch window, looks like. Launching from Kennedy Space Center from Launch Complex 39A. So yep, another Starlink.
After that is maybe a Starship launch. So like we mentioned earlier, they have issued their marine navigation warnings, but we're waiting on the FAA launch license. FAA thinks that they're going to be able to get it through, but we'll see if they wind up getting delayed. But yep, Starship Flight 3 is going to be taking off from their starbase in Texas sometime on March 14th between 1200 hours UTC and 1600 hours UTC.
Finally, Electron, and this is Live and Let Fly. So this is the NROL 123 payload that, you know, like all the other ones, we don't know what it is. So it's mission for the National Reconnaissance Office. This is launching from Wallops Island. So yeah, we were just talking about, I mean, we don't know, like what, the second or third maybe that has ever launched from Wallops, but it's launching from Launch Complex 2, Launch Area 0C. So I don't know how those designations work out, but I think they just have one pad. The launch time on the 20th is from 0615 UTC through 10:30 UTC. So a long launch window for that one as well, which is interesting. I'm always trying to think of what that means since it's a, you know, classified payload. Like if you have a 4-hour launch window, what does that tell us? I don't know.
That the payload can move.
That the payload can move. Okay, there you go. Well, no, that's maybe. Good. Yeah, that's actually useful. Yeah. That maybe it can move a lot. And so,
or else, you know, if it's going to a sun synchronous orbit, it's really particular when you launch it. But if you're just going to a polar orbit, you know, maybe it doesn't matter quite as much if you're hitting the same, you know, or orbiting with the sun, or, you know, who knows? It's all secrety. So those are your upcoming spaceflight events.
All right, which means it's time to do with the show, and we would like to thank Ron Jiggies and Tim Dodd for our music.
For more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, please visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com.
We record live on Sundays at 9 a.m. Pacific and 12 p.m. Eastern, and thank you so much to Chris S., the Greek VT, Vax Hedron, and Dennis O. for joining our recording session today and helping us make correction words on the fly.
If you want to support the show, please tell a friend, or better yet, leave us a review wherever you listen. You can visit theorbitalmechanics.com/support for our Patreon campaign and affiliate links. I wanted to say thank you to Mad Steve for upgrading to an AdCo support level on Patreon. Thank you so much.
And get in touch. Find links to our mailing list, Discord server, and Mastodon account at theorbitalmechanics.com/about, or you can skip all that just by emailing info@theorbitalmechanics.com. So we'll see you all next week on Orbit. Until then, later.
Goodbye, everybody.